are on study 65 of Genesis. As you've noticed, there are not 65 chapters of Genesis. But having said that, we are in chapter 47 of Genesis, and there are 50 chapters of Genesis. So we're getting close. We're almost finishing the study. I would say probably another 4 weeks we'll be done, I think. And then look, I think we'll be moving on to 1st and 2nd Timothy after we get done with Genesis. But we are right now in the Toldot of Jacob. We finished last week the sojourn to Egypt, which was Joseph bringing the entire family of Israel, including his dad, to Egypt, to the land of Goshen, introducing them to Pharaoh and starting to get them settled. The next portion we're going to look at here is the course of the famine. The course of the famine. And could someone... Well, here, I'll start us out. Take a look at chapter 47. Let's take a look at... verse 13 and 14. Verse 13 says this: "Now there was no food in all the land because the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. 14. Joseph gathered all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house." So in verse 13 here, when the scripture tells us now, this is after the move of all of the members of the family of Jacob to Egypt. And this all occurred about 2 years into the 7-year famine. So this is probably year 3 or 4 right here. And at this point in this 7-year famine, scripture tells us there was no food at all in both Egypt and Canaan. So you got to figure probably the all surrounding area. So what did Joseph at this point do in verse 14, at this point in the famine?
Gathered up all the money?
Yeah, how did he get all the dough in Egypt?
By selling the grain.
Yeah, so that's right. So basically... remember, he was part of this national plan to store the grain, store the food for 7 years. They've got a decent amount of food storage around the country, presumably. Now he's in the process of providing people food to eat in exchange for their money. This would be called, in today's day and age, gouging.
I was gonna say, because they were paying a tax percentage of what the people grew to give it to Pharaoh for storage. And now they're having to pay to get that same food back.
That's exactly right.
Double dipping.
That's exactly right. So Joseph is definitely taking advantage of the situation. But you think about gouging. I mean, it's very frowned upon, this idea of gouging in our Western culture. But if you think of just naked free enterprise, people acting in their own self-interest, these people, you know, their other choice was to starve. So they exchanged their liquid wealth for the food, for food to eat. And so Joseph, if you looked at any other natural leader, probably in world history, 99% of them would have gathered the wealth and launched a coup and taken over Pharaoh's job. No, that's not what he does. Obediently, Joseph is still working for this pagan king, this pagan emperor, and is obedient to his role and passes it on, enriching Pharaoh. Let's take a look at these next few verses. Could someone read verses 15 through 17?
"So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, 'Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed.' Then Joseph said, 'Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone.' So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the cattle of the herd, and of the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year."
Okay, so famine gets bad. And the what we read about earlier is the nation basically exchanges its, in today's legal parlance, you'd call it their intangible personal property, their stocks, their bonds, their currency in exchange for food. And verse 15 tells us when the money was all spent in the land, in other words, when the intangible personal property is gone, people don't have any of it left because they've exchanged it all for food. And the famine has continued. What's the next thing the folks do?
Land.
Not land. Okay. Livestock. They move on to tangible, in the law today, you call it tangible personal property. They've spent all the liquid assets. Now they're looking at artwork and what you'd say
cars.
Today. Cars. That's exactly right. They're exchanging livestock. Probably that was probably more valuable than the liquid wealth at that time. So they're exchanging now their tangible, all of it. Given it all to just to eat, to stay alive. And again, verse 16 tells us, Joseph says, give me your livestock and you'll get the food because the money's gone. And 17 says they bring their livestock to Joseph. Joseph gave them food in exchange for their personal property, horses, flocks, herds, donkeys. And so the people of Egypt make it the next year. All the while, the oligarchy, the monarchy of Egypt, the government is getting more, the total wealth, basically.
I would also say that since most people don't save very well at all, that transition probably happened within the first year.
It could have been, yeah.
Probably for a lot of people within the first several months or quarter. And so right off the bat, he's looking like a great producer for Pharaoh.
I think that's probably true, yeah.
He's like, man, this guy.
That's probably true.
I don't understand how the livestock can be alive when there's a famine.
That's a good point.
That's a great question.
Because the livestock have to go ahead and graze. And,
it's true.
If there's a famine, then that means that it's like desolate land.
Yeah,
the livestock over there is more valuable than money, and so they feed their livestock before they feed themselves.
I think that what Jeremy's point is well taken, Rod, in that when it tells us the famine is so severe, we've got to balance it with the fact that there's livestock still alive. So it's not like Stalin murdering 30 million people in the Ukraine by starving them to death. It's not that bad. But it's bad enough that people are probably making some very stark choices with what they have. And some of it may be to keep the livestock alive and feed themselves. So there's some kind of balancing going on.
There are very poor people that don't have livestock too. And the leaders would have been responsible for them. So they need bread.
That's right, yeah. So there are probably a portion of the population that even doesn't have livestock, but is relying on the goodness of the government and other people. But your point's well taken. It's not that bad that the livestock, it's not like people are eating their horses and bark yet. But it's getting there. Could someone read verses 18 through 22?
When that year was over, they came to him the following year and said, "We cannot hide from our Lord the fact that since our money is gone and our livestock belong to you, there is nothing left for our Lord except our bodies and our land. Why should we perish before your eyes, we and our land as well? Buy us and our land in exchange for food, and we with our land will be in bondage to Pharaoh. Give us seed so that we may live and not die, and that the land may not become desolate."
322, Richard, if you don't mind.
So Joseph bought all the land in Egypt for Pharaoh. The Egyptians, one and all, sold their fields, became the famine, because the famine became severe for them. The land became Pharaoh's, and Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to the other. However, he did not buy the land of the priests, because they received regular allotment from Pharaoh and had food enough from the allotment. Pharaoh gave them. That is why they did not sell their land.
Okay, great. Thank you, Richard. So, first step, people exchanged all their intangible personal property for food to eat. That gets all absorbed by the government. The next step is people exchange their tangible personal property, livestock, to eat. Now you have verse 18. When that year was ended, so again, we're at the third step now of this progress of the famine. They came to him the next year and said to him, "We'll not hide from my Lord that our money is spent and the cattle are all my Lord's. There's nothing left for my Lord except what? Yeah. So two more items of wealth. One would be the land, which in our legal parlance today you'd call real property. Now, there's another item of wealth that they mention that's not considered property in our legal system, in our rule of law. What is considered wealth to them that's not considered wealth to us?
Their livelihood, their life.
Their bodies, right? What's another word for that?
Labor.
Yeah, labor. Think Civil War. What's another word for that?
Slavery.
Slavery, yeah. 13th Amendment prohibits slavery in this culture. 13th Amendment's not that old. Slavery was around until not just recently. But from ancient times, it's been considered a form of wealth. And so people are reduced now, and in cultures today, it's considered a form of wealth. They're reduced to now disposing of their real property, their stake in the land, just to eat, and then selling themselves into servitude just to remain alive. So this is how bad it gets. And they explained the rationale for this in verse 19. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we and our land will be slaves to Pharaoh. Now, in addition to food, what else do they ask for at the end of verse 19?
Seed.
Yeah, so apparently, again, the famine is such that, and I'm not sure how this is working, but there does seem to be some means of production still to be able to produce food, maybe in limited quantities, and that's what they're asking for, as well as just food to keep them alive. And verse 20 says, Joseph acquired all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, not for himself, because all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was so severe upon them, and therefore, basically, all the land in Egypt became the government's. Now, Richard, I want to ask you a question. Verse 21, could you read your verse 21 again?
And Joseph reduced the people to servitude from one end of Egypt to the other.
Okay, great. And what version do you have again? Is it NIV?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anyone's verse 22 say something different than Richard's? Or verse 21, I'm sorry. What does yours say, Chase?
As for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other.
Yeah, so there is a difference in how this is being translated. And I don't have an opinion on what the Hebrew says. The New American Standard also says, as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the others. I would guess that to the cities is a more literal reading, but I would presume that the NIV is making an editorial translation that in doing that, it's part of their servitude, because Richard Version says he reduced them to servitude. So,
well, he's gathering together to where he can control
them. Gathering them for control, gathering them for to have leaders in charge of them to give them orders, yeah. It's an interesting comment about cities, though, too, I guess, to some degree. Jeremy?
No, I'm not 100% knowledgeable on the timeline of Egypt, but isn't this kind of early stage of Egypt, and maybe this is where they went from, say, the 13 colonies to the 50 states?
Yeah, so give me your thoughts on what you're thinking.
That Egypt beforehand was, before this famine, was a great nation, but not
very
the kingdom.
Super,
that
yeah, perfect.
Came, not the,
so when you think about Egypt, what do you think of from this vantage point in our history?
From what we've been reading?
No, just from your basically elementary school.
That they were the thousands of years of reigning.
Okay, good. And so what did Egypt produce? When you think of, if you went to Egypt, is there anything you would go visit?
Pyramids.
Okay, good. That's what I'm getting at. Okay. So are you thinking that, you know,
pre-monument, pre...
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, I mean, I don't know where in the Egyptian history, you know, biblical...
Does it say which pharaoh? Does it give a name of the pharaoh?
Good question. And there is some debate as to... There are two accepted timelines in evangelical... Well, actually, in evangelical Christianity, the accepted timeline for... Moses' departure from Egypt is about 1400 BC. So that would put this around 1800 BC, what's going on here. most secular historians who think that the Bible is myth, but grounded maybe in some historical experience, they would place whatever happened, they don't necessarily believe in Moses per se, but whatever happened, if there were some people called Hebrews that left Egypt, it would have had to have happened around 1200 BC. Now, that 200 years is not that big a difference between how evangelicals might see it, people that believe in the Bible and are strict about interpretation versus secular historians.
That's a couple generations.
Well, the only reason that, and I'm going to, let's talk about this right now, because it's a decent point that you raise. The only reason secular historians place the departure 200 years later than what we would if we were studying the Bible and putting together a timeline, working with back, especially from David backwards, is, and if I don't find it now, I'm not going to waste a bunch of time, but suffice it to say, we read, I believe, earlier in chapter 47 and 46, when Joseph brought Israel into the land of Goshen, it was called something. And it was called the city of Ramses. And again, I can't point you the verse, but we've read it last week. The idea was when they came to Goshen, it was the city of Ramses. Now, there is a pharaoh named Ramses that's well accounted for in secular history. And the problem is that Ramses was this 1200 BC time frame. So if you're following kind of a literal timeline of the Bible, that would be a problem you'd have to work through. Was there an earlier Ramses that's just not mentioned in secular history that could be corroborated with, you know, archaeology? Or it may be this. This may be the more likely solution as to what's going on. And we're going way off track to some degree, but for those of you who are interested, it's a good question. It may be this. Who wrote Genesis? Yes. And Joseph is writing about these events 400 years after they occurred. Maybe generation. So if Moses is writing, it's probably 1400-ish BC. Now, that's another problem, because you're thinking, well, if Ramses was around 1200, till 12, Moses couldn't have known about him. So there's one of two solutions here. Either there was another Ramses that's not corroborated in archaeology as the Ramses in the time period most secular historians know of, or it may be that someone made an editorial addition to Moses' manuscript, and we don't even know for sure Moses wrote it. That's what everyone basically agrees on. But there may have been an editorial addition inspired by God telling us that, yeah, this land, Goshen, it's the city of Ramses, for those who are reading this now. Yeah. 11. I'm sorry, 20...
Verse 11.
47:11?
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Paul. Yeah, take a look at this. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, good, as Pharaoh had ordered. So that really verse causes this controversy in timing. So other than that, that's all I can tell you, Jeremy. I don't know how folks that would take the Bible literally, I don't know where they would place the pyramids in this whole time frame. You know, if they would place it in that 400-year period while Israel was enslaved, whether Israel participated in building the pyramids or Sphinx, I'm not positive.
I mean, just from what we're reading right here, it sounds like he not only ended up with the land of Egypt, but because they brought Canaan in before, that's when they really became a superpower, because it feels to me that maybe that's when they took over all of the Nile and all of Canaan.
So I like your thinking, too, in this, even though I'm ignorant of when the pyramids were built, I would say that if you just look at the biblical evidence and not even think about Israel, the whole nation became in servitude. If it became a totalitarian regime where everyone is really a slave, that, to me, would say that's probably the time period of the labor being produced, these religious monuments.
Overnight, because...
Yeah,
One year it's money, one year it's cattle, and year three it's the people in the land.
Yeah.
Well, I would just say that, you know, the White House was built with slavery, I learned this summer. I thought that was interesting. But the engine that made America make a lot of money was slavery. I mean, there's just really not a lot of doubt about that.
The whole Southern economy was based
on
slavery.
And that engine is what really gave us the finances to then perform and become an independent. Not that that's right, but that's what happened.
Sure,
and I think it's the same thing here.
The Hebrew slavery engine drove all this economic power.
And remember, these Egyptians are becoming slaves even to Pharaoh as well. And Joseph is the architect of all this. That's exactly right.
Well, look at when the nation of Israel, when they get together, do they do things on a small scale or do they do things on a grand scale? They are blessed.
Yeah, right. So this may be also part of the the idea of the pyramids is that stuff being built, maybe part of the Abrahamic blessing. Yeah. I'll bless those who bless you, and Egypt may have. Yeah, that's a great point. Egypt may have participated in the blessing.
I said it was a blessing to be in slavery.
Well, it was a blessing to Pharaoh.
they was either starve or be.
It's true. They didn't have much choice, did they? There was a famine. Okay, let's take a look at this next section here. Could someone read?
23.
Okay, yeah, let's take a look at 22. I don't want to skip that. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had an allotment from the Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land.
It's good to be the priest.
Yeah. By the way, this same system was in existence in medieval Europe. The priesthood, the church, the religious entity owned land and was exempt, from government ownership. Or
still today, isn't it? There's tax benefits for.
There is definitely, but the level of correlation between government and religion was much more in place.
Church and state.
Yeah, so you got here in verse 22. Some land remains with the priesthood. These pagan priests, these people that worship the sun god Ra. And as a good reminder, remember that Joseph, chosen by Yahweh, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, his father-in-law is the chief pagan priest, Potiphera, and his daughter is Joseph's wife. So Joseph is right here in the midst, intermarried in this whole pagan system. Yet he's maintaining his identity as an obedience to the God, the one true God, the only God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, it's tough to do, but I wouldn't encourage anyone here to try to carry it out. And you need to look at the later revelation of Scripture to figure out how you walk your walk as a believer. But he was able to do it.
Potiphar couldn't answer the question, that Joseph could.
I think exactly. Also that's driven home by the fact that he three times a day or whenever they eat, eats at a different table.
That's right. They still excluded.
Table in his own family.
And that was almost because they didn't want to eat with him. It wasn't because he was being elitist. That's right. Take a look at, could someone read verses 23 through 26?
And Chris, it's also striking that the Hebrews got caught in this slavery system.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Exactly as God said they would.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. 20. Could someone read 23 through 26?
And Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may now sow the land. At the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and fourth-fifth shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food and for those of your households, as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves." Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth, only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jay. So, they become slaves, but the slavery is not, it's not like you'd consider a southern or recent form of American slavery. It's more of an indentured servitude it works out to, and here's why. Verse 23, Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here's," so he gives him seed, "you go sow the land." Now the land is owned by
Pharaoh.
That's right. So now these people are slaves and tenants on Pharaoh's land. Good. And what's their rent in verse 24?
20%.
Okay, yeah. So during the years of increase, it was a tax, but they own the land. Now they don't even own the land, and now they got to pay rent. If it's 20%.
Flat tax.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
They're living in their own homes, right?
Presumably, yeah. They're back on the same places, but without the deed.
Yeah.
With a lease.
Yeah.
And, But nonetheless, verse and by the way, we're talking about medieval Europe again. This is a lot like medieval Christianity, and you know, you had lords with fiefdoms. The serfs lived that close to a castle. They didn't own the land. They had to pay rent for the land, and they were indentured servant. But the religious folks were exempt from any of this system. Verse 25, as you mentioned, Chase, they realize that, look, despite the fact that they've been reduced to indentured servitude, they say, you have saved our lives. Let us find favor in your sight, and we will be Pharaoh's slave. There is some gratitude for this condition that they're in. And so Joseph, verse 26, made a statute concerning the land valid to this day. Now, again, that tells us that someone is writing after these events. We think it's Moses, but if there's someone else involved after Moses, if, you know, there may have been other editors later, that at the time that verse was written, this was still going on in Egypt. Now, if Genesis was written in 1400 BC, it was probably pretty recent. If it was written in 1300 BC, 1200 BC, whatever the time Genesis was written, this was still going on. And at the end of verse 26, only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's. So that moves us to our next portion, and this is Jacob in Egypt. Jacob in Egypt. Could someone read verses 27 through 31?
Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years, so the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "Please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt, so when I lay down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place." And he said, I will do as you have said. He said, "Swear to me." So he swore to him. Then Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed.
Okay, thanks, Chase. So verse 27 tells us, as the nation of Israel, the proto-nation of Israel in Goshen is there, check it out, verse 27, they become fruitful and numerous. They start to grow. They start to multiply. They start to move from family into nationhood. Verse 28 tells us, okay, so Jacob has come down from the land of Israel into Egypt, and how long is he in Egypt?
17
years, okay? So that means that he came in at 130, and the Bible tells us that he lived to be at 147. So now this is... So you got to figure at this point in time, Joseph, if this is the end, if we're getting towards the end of Jacob's life, 147, and Jacob entered the land at age 130, then this makes Joseph probably around the age of 56. Joseph was around 39-ish at the point when this was going down, when Jacob came into the land. So you add 17 years to that, and you come up with Joseph's age, which would be approximately mid-50s. And verse 29, when the time for Israel drew near, that tells us that it's probably towards the end of this 17-year period in Egypt, he called Joseph. Now, what does he want from Joseph?
Go back to
guarantee.
Guarantee, yeah. What's he want Joseph's promise or guarantee?
Bury him in this foreign land that'll take him back to where
So he's really very serious about this idea that he not be buried in Egypt. And so much so, he goes through this ritual that is very, I mean, it's, you know, a lot more important than today, you know, three witnesses and three notaries. Rod.
What's wrong with that?
Those notaries.
Get your stone out.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So why do you think it's so important to Jacob, that what's Jacob here? He's dead.
I think he feels God told him that's what you're supposed to do.
That's right. What's the Abrahamic covenant? This land I'm giving to you and your descendants forever. And remember, before Jacob even left Canaan, last chapter, to come into Egypt, he stopped in Beersheba at the very south of Israel, and he went through this process of offering sacrifices, and it sounds like really seeking the Lord to find out, this is the land you've said to me, is this something you want me to do, to leave this land that is promised to me and my descendants forever? And the Lord tells him, go, I'll be with you. But the idea of this covenant and his whole life being around this covenant is so important to him that two things. One is the land is the land promise is so important that even if he dies, even if he doesn't return before he dies, he wants to be buried there. And probably, like I said, Tim, to honor this covenant, to make sure he's honoring this covenant. And what else do you think? What else do you think Jacob believes about his future other than that he'll be die and be buried?
Resurrect.
Jacob believes he will be resurrected. Probably. Because he's always talked about, I'm going to be with my father. So he knows Abraham and Isaac are somewhere, and he's going to be with them at some point. And he also knows, he promised me and my descendants the land, so that may be going through his mind as well. Now, nonetheless, again, this just really hammers down the importance of the section of how important and how central it was to the modus operandi of Jacob during his entire lifetime, and that is this promise that that land would be like his forefathers Abraham and Isaac and his descendants forever. So he says in verse 31, swear to me that you'll return me to that land. And so Joseph does agree to that guarantee, and Jacob bows in honor of and thankfulness.
Doesn't he also have a problem with his dying? From, I mean, I know that you made an allusion to this before in other passages.
But yeah. So
this is where he was wrestling.
That's true.
He's got a thigh issue. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, and so, not to get too technical, but help me out here. Where's the thigh verse? Oh, yeah, verse 29. Now place your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness. When Jacob was wrestling with the angel, the Hebrew word for hide or thigh was, translated in English as thigh, was likely the hip or the sinew, the hamstring maybe. I believe that this translation of the Hebrew is a different Hebrew word still translated in English. When this happened earlier, and I'm forgetting the circumstance, when a similar oath was taken. If you can recall...
Give me Abraham.
Yeah.
For my son.
Sagan?
It was asking his servant, go get a wife for my son.
Yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. We talked about this. At that point, we talked about the fact that what was going on, the Hebrew definitely was translated more delicately in English as thigh. But... what's real? Do you remember what's really going on here?
He was holding on the family jewel.
This is the genitals. They're grabbing the testicles, if not the penis itself. Why? We talked about this before. It's because that's the source of authority. That's the source of destiny. That's the source of future. It's the family jewels, and it's the it's a very important. So it gets translated a little bit more acceptably into English.
So this is more of that connotation.
That's more of that than what happened, I think, with the wrestling with the angel.
Okay. I think that would be the equivalent of the early 1900s of putting your hand on the Bible and swearing.
That's exactly right, yeah. I'm glad we just do that now. Well, actually, I took I had to do a deposition last week. You don't even put your hand on the Bible
really?
Anymore. No. Okay, so we'll do this last passage and then we'll be done here. Let's take a look at... Oh, that actually finishes the section on Jacob and Egypt. Let's take a look at the blessing of Ephraim and Manasseh. And that moves us to chapter 48. Could someone read verses 1 through 4?
Sometime later, Joseph was told your father is ill, so he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. When Jacob was told your son Joseph has come to you, Israel rallied his strength and sat up in bed. Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me and said to me, I am going to make you fruitful and increase your numbers. I will make you a community of people, and I will give you this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you.
Perfect. Thanks, Paul. So verse 1 says, Now it came out after these things, so after this vow that Joseph gave to his father that he'll return him to the land of Israel, Joseph was told, so at some point there was some kind of separation between dad and Joseph. Joseph went back to the job. Later, Joseph is told. What's Joseph told?
Dad's not well.
Dad's sick. And so, it's likely that Joseph may believe what?
This is it.
This is it, yeah. Joseph's probably, and it's likely that we know Joseph believes that, because what does Joseph do? He wants a blood, kind of like what Esau and Jacob did with Isaac. He wants dad to bless his son. So, he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, with him. And when it was told, so someone announces to Jacob, "Behold, your son Joseph has come to you." Israel collects his strength, sat up in bed. Again, there's some people think that that's not a good translation of the Hebrew. Some people believe that this bed word might be translated better as raised up on his staff. Nonetheless, he's old and he's having a tough time. He awakens, he starts to collect his thinking and his thoughts. And verse 3, what is Jacob? He sees Joseph's there. What does Jacob say to Joseph? Yeah, this is basically, again, a restatement of the Abrahamic covenant. This covenant that has been the central force for these people, this people group, for this third, fourth, fifth generation now, if you consider Jacob and his kids. So he says, look, God appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me, verse 40. And he told me then, this is exactly what he told me. Four things he told me. I'm going to make you fruitful. One, I'm going to make you numerous. Two, and multiply you, or make you a company of peoples or a nation. Or three, that would make you a company of peoples or a nation. And four, I'm going to give you this land as a possession for your descendants, for you and your descendants after you. So, again, before, it's kind of like, it may be Jacob realizing that Joseph's bringing his kids for blessing, but before you ask me what you want from me, I want to tell you this to remind you of a couple things. You may be a hot shot in Egypt here. Well, first, remember your promise, probably. When I die, I need you to bury me where I want to go. And also, too, you may be a hot shot in Egypt here, but remember this. The whole reason we're here is because of Yahweh. He told you this whole deal was going down, and I'm giving you my interpretation of probably what Jacob's saying. Remember that the whole reason you're in this position is because our God, who gave this promise to us, gave you this information, which caused you to be raised in this land, and you're a descendant of mine. And these kids are going to ask me to bless their descendants of mine as well, and their inheritance is not Egypt, it's this land. So next week we'll continue on and see exactly how Jacob blesses Joseph's kids. Thanks, Tim.
Jeff.